Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. As I said, the next share is in 2 weeks, Rabbi Jeremy Weider. Without further ado, I want to thank again Rabbi Eli Rubin for volunteering of his time to give of his Torah, and Rabbi Rubin.
Thank you. It's the contrary. It's an honor. Thank you for inviting me to address you tonight. There are so many outstanding issues in Parshat Toldot. You would certainly need more than 45 minutes to do justice to this great story. I'd like to start, though, nevertheless, with what seems to be the Torah's indication that Yitzchak loved Esav and Yaakov, Rivka loved Yaakov. So I want to see the text inside, and then we're going to circle back a little bit to Parshat Chayesara, go a little bit further down into Parshat Toldot, and come back to some of these themes. So if you open, please open your Chumashim to page... it's a Perek Kaf He, Pasuk Kaf He. Perek Kaf He, Pasuk Kaf He. I'm sorry, I'm using a different Chumash, so I don't have the page.
127,
thank you. It's rather straightforward. As we'll see, maybe not so straightforward. And with your permission, at the end of this class, I'd like to add a little bit of my own personal insight. Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav, ki tzayit befiv, v'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. Those of you who are comfortable with Hebrew, what would be the distinctions, the differences between the way that these two descriptions are given by the Torah? A couple of differences that kind of stand out. Tense, right. Vayehav is either vav ha-mapech, it's either in the past tense or atid. We'll see Rav Kook, even though the comment, it's mostly points to vav ha-mapech, which would make it in past tense. Rav Kook, in a homiletic way, describes it in the future. We'll get back to that. So there is a tense difference with Yitzchak, whereas Rivka's love for Yaakov is in the present. Ohevet. One other difference?
One is dependent on something.
Good, excellent. Excellent. So there's an Ahava Shetluya B'Dabar when it comes to Yitzchak's love for Esav. Yitzchak loves Esav because he has this hunting food in his mouth. V'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. She seems to unconditionally love him because of his character, because of her son. And the third piece, which I didn't expect then really to indicate, but generally speaking about both of them, is that there is a distinction and a demarcation in the relationships between the parents and the children, which in and of itself is the third troubling factor that arises from this pasuk. Obviously, one has to think that it's not mutually exclusive. It's not Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav, and he doesn't love Yaakov. And it's not Verivko Hevet Yaakov, and she doesn't love Esav. It's an easy way to back out of it. But certainly the Chumash does indicate that there is a demarcation. The end of this parsha is an interesting Rashi. I wasn't planning on mentioning it. It says, Aim Yaakov Esav. By Rivka, for those who remember when they were splitting up, it says Rivka was Ein Yaakov and Esav. Rashi says in that case, so I don't know why the Torah has to tell me that. We know that she's the Ein. When I always look at that Rashi ends with that question. He doesn't give an answer. And so I think from a pedagogic place, Rashi was trying to instruct us that we're just going to come across comments in the Torah, words that we don't understand. And if Rashi doesn't understand something, it's okay for us not to understand it. I would go back and circle back to the beginning. Is it's trying to at least mollify those who think that to some degree there was a demarcation here or a distinction between the mother's love for one child or the other, and there isn't a love for the second or for the first. I want to study this pasuk in the context of the relationship. So I'd like to first share with you the Ramban's question, which is not here. The Ramban asked this question of Kav Zayin, but it's very relevant. Rivka had the advantage in this relationship because Rivka had the nevuah, she had the prophecy. What was the prophecy? Let's go back to the beginning of the parsha. Hi. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the parsha. What was the prophecy? Rivka was vayitretzu bani bekirba, vatomer imkein lamaze anochi, vateil chajoshad Hashem am perek kaf hei pasuk kaf gimel. And she has some. She either goes. She finds out. There's a machloket here. Does she have tefillah, or does she have a prophecy? Does she go to someone to give her a prophecy? And in any event, vatelech lidrosh et Hashem pasuk kav gimel vayomer Hashem lah. And God says to her, shnei goyim bevitnech u'shnei lu'umim b'ma'ayich yiparedu u'la'om l'om ye'emat v'rav yavot seir. You have two nations that are part of your pregnancy. You have twins. And the younger one will overpower the older one. And the older one will be subservient to the younger one in some fashion, in some manner. So when you get to Pasuk Kaf Hei, it's enigmatic. It says, "Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav ki tzayit befiv Rivka ohev et Yaakov." Well, Rivka knew that. Rivka knew that Yaakov was the preferred son. And let's remember, in the book of Bereishit, it's all about splitting children. Cain and Hevel was a split. Abraham had to distinguish between Yitzchak and Ishmael, and it's not by accident now that it's between Yaakov and Esav. And by the way, that is the same narrative that informs the brothers with Yosef, because Yosef, it seemed to the brothers that Yosef was going to be chosen over the other brothers, would be deselected. So it would seem that Rivka loved Yaakov because he was the chosen child. So the Ramban asks what is a very important question. If you look in your own page number one, Bavur Tivarecha Nafshi Haya Bedatola Varecho Toshi Iskeh Beberkat Avraham Vinira, second line, under where it's underlined. Shalohi Gida Lo Rivka Miolam HaNevuah Asher Ama Hashem La. It seems, Ramban says, that Rivka never shared this prophecy with Yitzchak. She either obfuscated, or she kept it obscure, or she just avoided the conversation altogether. This is the Ramban's way of asking a question, by the way. In other words, if you to flip it around, what would Ramban's question? Why didn't Rivka share it? She had this really important, relevant, and pertinent information. I don't know if you've ever had this with your spouses. When you come home and you found out you missed something, or you should have shared something, and Hakim did tell me. And of course, the conversation always goes, yes, I did tell you, and you weren't listening. But we know, is that kind of a universal problem? I did tell you. And you can just keep on promoting that approach. Whether you said it or not, if you say that, you're always safe. I absolutely told you, even though you know in your heart of hearts, you know it was never said. But it's somewhere along the line. It does inject an element of doubt that maybe you really did say it and the other person forgot, especially after 30 years old. So the question here is really Rivka Ramban's question. V'nira shalohi gidelo Rivka miolam v'nubuar shamala v'rav yavot zayir ki eich haya Yitzchak over et pi Hashem v'hi lo tetzlach. It would never be successful. Yitzchak was not only misinformed, he was misguided. And by the way, Ramban at this stage puts Yitzchak's mistaken love at the fault of Rivka, right at her feet, because she could have told him. Look at his answer, it's very interesting. V'hinei mitchila lo higida lo derech musar v'tzniut. So at first, Ramban says, Rivka never told Yitzchak because it was a sense of inner modesty and ethical behavior. She went to seek out God, and Yitzchak didn't know. So then she was kind of stuck. She backed herself into a very awkward position. She went to find out the truth about her pregnancy, never shared the initiative with her husband, and now she has this answer, and she can't double back and say, oh, Yitzchak, remember when I was out the other day, I meant to tell you, I went to Vatelach Joshad Hashem. So she felt that she got this nevuah, and it would just disappear and fade into the sunset. Or she said, the Ramban says, maybe another interpretation is, why would I even need to tell my prophecy to a Navi? Ki hu gadol mi amagidli. I should tell my husband what I just found out? Of course he knows. He knows so much better than I do. I would be futile, almost embarrassing for me to share this great revelation for something that a man of his stature probably either intuited or knew because he had his own prophecy. Which is another marital kind of this miscommunication where we just assume the other one knew and why should I tell you, or something of the sense that someone was greater than me. So the Ramban gives us at least a frame here that Yitzchak didn't know and Rivka did know. So therefore this demarcation of love, according to the Ramban, doesn't get an explanation why one would love one more than the other, but it gives us at least some indication that Yitzchak was misinformed. Parenthetically, on that same subject, even though it's not directly related to what we really wanted to get to, but I think it's still important, I want to circle back to the Netziv. Because the Netziv has the same question in different language, which is on the right of the page. So the Netziv, right where it says, you see where it says the arrow, a very small font, where it says Ramban, Kav Zayin Dalet, in my own handwriting? Because these go together. This Netziv and the Ramban are like their first cousins, with a couple hundred years separating them. Vatikach HaTzeif HaTitkas. Do you remember the story? Rivka was coming back from Padan Aram, and she sees Yitzchak from a distance, and she asks, "Mi Yishal is there? Who is this person?" Vatikachat Saifa Titkas, and she covers herself. Vatipol Mi Hagamal. It's a very interesting story that needs more amplification, but that you'll have to wait all the way till we get to Chayisera for next year. We missed the opportunity. Yeah, but I'm already giving the only shir I know in Chayisera. So this is it. So it's not me. We have either a weeder with a D or a weener with an N. Vatikachat Saifa Titkas. Mirop pachad ubusha. She was so embarrassed and humiliated, kamosha mevina she'ina ruya lo liot liisha. She felt so inadequate in his presence that she covered herself in from discomfort. Umi'az vehala, and from that moment on, nigba biliba pachad. She has always had this reverence in her relationship to Yitzchak. V'lo hayta in Yitzchak kamo Sarai im Abraham, v'Rachel in Yaakov. And he and she did not enjoy the same type of dialogical relationship that Abraham had with Sarah or Rachel had with Yaakov. Asher behayot lahem ezo kpeda lahem, when there was a disagreement or discord or there was some a misalignment, lo boshu lidaber retet lifnehem. They made their feelings very clear. Mashenkin rifkav v'kol zeh hakdama l'sipur she'yavo v'parshat Toldot. And all of this is an introduction and a context creation for the next story of Toldot, because they were very they were divided in their positions when it came to raising their children. The Netziv frames this. I don't know if you've ever come across the Netziv. It's a very interesting analysis of, I wouldn't say not me to judge what's a healthy and unhealthy marriage, but certainly in a non-communicative relationship. And that all originated from Rivka's lineage. Her family was one of didn't have the same type of legacy and the same type of distinction that Yitzchak had, and she felt inadequate, unequal, unaligned in their relationship, and when there's a disproportionality in the relationship because of whatever assumed inadequacy, then it creates also a breakdown in communication because there isn't that sense of a real fairness and openness. A very interesting comment that the Netziv gives, but now further explains how we ended up with this problem. So both the Ramban and the Netziv, both trying to back it up. It's the prequel. It's the prequel to Parsha Toldot. Why did Yitzchak vayehevet Esav and Rivka vayehevet Yaakov? So the Ramban says that he never had the information because she was either embarrassed or she just assumed he knew. Similarly, the Netziv says she deliberately couldn't share because she didn't have a dialogical, sharing, communicating relationship with him. By the way, point out this week when you're in the shul and listen, when you read Parsha Toldot, I always say this with some degree of hesitance and reticence and ambivalence because I actually have to check it word for word, but I've been thinking this for years already. I do believe it's true. There's no dialogue between Yitzchak and Rivka. The only dialogue between Yitzchak and Rivka comes at the end of this Parsha. It's almost a speechless way of marriage. I know, it's true. Yitzchak is a passive person also, yes.
There's that one time though when they're playing together, right?
Yeah, Mitzache, right.
Right. So how would that factor
in? Because Yitzchak was the initiator in the relationship. Rivka, according to the Netziv, was someone who felt always inadequate, even though she got the prophecy and he didn't. She came with some sense of inferiority, which gave him the kind of leverage. And that's why he was going to bless the children. He didn't consult with her. He didn't say, Rivka, what do you think? What's the plan? You know, you're my partner in this relationship. There was just... It wasn't a relationship that was based on equality, which it's, you know, there are different models in all of the Chumashim.
Inferiority. She goes ahead and tells Yaakov what to do behind the radius.
Well, that's part of it, because instead of confronting Yitzchak later and actually opposing his position and trying to redirect him, she felt inadequate and uncomfortable in any way confronting him, so therefore she had a...
By not willing to completely go around.
She engineered it.
Okay.
She engineered it because it was easier for her to engineer this or manipulate it than it was to confront him. And that's what the Tzib would say. This is a theme throughout the entire parsha between Rivka and Yitzchak. That it was Rivka's inadequacy that prevented her from creating a dialogue around raising these children. In fact, the Shimshon Fel Hirsch, who oftentimes gives psychological insights and educational insights into children rearing, if you take a look in the bottom of the page, Rigashot HaHorim, it's circled, it says, Rav Shimshon Fel Hirsch is the last commentary on the first page, Rigashot HaHorim Hayu Chalukim B'yachas LeBeneihem. Their parents, their feelings of their children were distinct, they were different, they were not aligned. This will never end in something good when parents have different approaches to raising children. Remember, the Netziv and Rav Shimshon Fel Hirsch remember, they're 1700s, 1800s, where the world of psychology, or at least emotional insight, was much more in the language than it was, let's say, in the period of the Ramban. So you do see more of an insight into human personality as you get into the later years of exegesis. The top of that page, Achdut de'ot b'yachas l'chinuch v'shava l'chol abonim. You have to have, at least it should be a unified approach to raising children in a family, and a love, and there has to be, Buddha's right, he's very realistic, there has to be a fair, equal, proportionate love for all of your children. I'm going to come back to this, because I have my own insight that I want to share at the end of this class. Gam el ha-likuyim b'midoteyam, even recognizing children's faults, haskukim la'ava mesura od yoter, may hacholim b'gufam. Children who have character faults need to have more love and almost overcompensation than children who even are physically ill. Heim hatanai hayesod v'avnei ha-pina l'chol chinuch. This is the foundational principles that should guide all education. Amnam, b'koach ha-meshicha shel ha-nigudim, if you look that opposites attract, nuchal l'avin b'nakel et avat Yitzchak el Esav. But if we don't, if we move away from the ideal of children of education, and we look at the reality in this particular instance, Rav Shmuel Hirsch says it's very understandable. He said because there is an attraction of opposites. He says the following: Abba Yitzchak Reisa v'Abba Rivka Yaakov Yitzchak Shaya Olat Mima. He was a pure, holy soul. Hitrachek mi amulat ulam, and he was distanced himself from all of the complications of the world. The edifet neota sheket bebe'er lechi, and he looked for a serene life of distance and to some degree of isolation. Al pnei achevra noshita uma, and he was not engaging in the external culture of the world. Yitachen shuavet elf yoshel Esav, he loved Esav more. Ha'oz v'ha'no'az b'ma'asotav. Esav had what he was lacking. This type of worldly engagement, this fearless initiative, this resolve, this gumption, the ability to take risks without necessarily fear of consequences. Ha'oz v'no'az b'ma'asotav. Ha'masugal anigit abayit b'kisharon shalal shalo. He felt that Esav would even rise above him in talent. Kenegdo Rivka. Ra'atav Yaakov et ha'dmut ha'shlema. She saw the opposite of what she was raised in a family of those who were around in they were malicious, they were engaged in malfeasance, and there was malice and dishonesty. Ha'ruchuka b'tachlit mikol musag beit aveh. So therefore, Rivka was attracted to the son that she felt would compensate for what she was lacking, and Yitzchak was attracted to Esav to, so to speak, to give him the solace for what he didn't have in his own life. And therefore, Achalum l'chavenet chinucham l'yisod rikshot amumam u'polim keila. So this is a misguided way to raise children. But he does not try in any way, Rav Shmuel Hirsch, to create a justification. He's not looking for a smooth, packaged explanation for what seemed to be dysfunction. He lays it out. And in fact, Rav Shmuel Hirsch is consistent, because Rav Shmuel Hirsch writes in another place, and it's commentary in Chumash around Avraham, I think, he writes that we should never try to create ideals and perfection out of the Avot. So we'll never be able to learn from the Avot and the Imot if we create these ideals of impossibility and improbability. And in fact, if you look, let's say, with the advent in the generation that we've been in, the recent generations with the proliferation of publication, there's much more of a proclivity to create faultless, flawless leaders of the Avot and the Imot. Certainly in our generation and in this generation that we're living and watching it, there are major publications that are dedicated to creating these perfect models of Torah observance without in any way, without certainly not amplifying faults, but to some degree even just sublimating them as if they didn't exist. And Rav Shlomo Frist and the Netziv and the Ramban and many others in the previous generations were critical of this approach of Torah study, because how do you learn from someone or model a life if someone was perfect? So that's why Rav Shlomo Frist is not at all hesitant to criticize the Yitzchak and Rivka, because he thinks there's a lesson to be learned from this. It didn't work. And of course the outcome wasn't catastrophic, but it was certainly, unfortunately, very very significantly misguided. I don't want to be passing judgment on the words that we use. So this is the way Rav Shlomo Frist looks at it. I want to show you, by the way, I'll come back to that. Okay. We start moving away from that. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook has a very interesting comment. It's the page right above it. It's a new Chumash publication that came out. I only have three of the volumes, and I know that Torah is five, so I know that I'm missing two. My math has really been really quite exceptional. I can only give a shiur on this as long as I'm invited in during Bereishit. Well, I guess I have two others, but Vayev Yitzchak et Esav Kitzayv Yitzchak Avinu Haya Emshech Shel Akivun HaIdiali HaRuchani Shel Avram Avinu. Rav Cook says, the second Rav Cook, that Yitzchak was taking over the role of idealism from Yaakov, from his father, who commanded his children to take on the mantle of what would be considered the ethical, moral ways of Judaism. Mother Ramban, you know, says man mitzvotav hu katav mitzvotav. There are plenty of midrashim that say that the avot were observant of all the Torah. I'm sure you've come across that. Ramban says that's just not. That's not what happened. It's not what happened. There was what were they able to intuit? They were able to observe, and whatever they learned from the period of time, seasonally, situationally, they incorporated. But there's just too much inconsistency to say that the avot were all observant of all aspects of Torah. You won't be surprised to see those types of midrashim. I always tell my students that when you see a midrash, you have to ask yourself what was missing in the chumash that the midrash had to complete, which is usually metaphoric. And when Medrash is taken too far to the extent that it's going to always be interpreted as literal, then it creates a kind of a whole, almost a simplistic way of studying Chumash. Because Medrash is much more complex than just a little interpretation. Because which ones are literal, which ones are metaphoric, I leave it to you to try to understand. And anyway, he said, Rav Tzvi Yehuda says, something very painful happens at this point of life. And you know, Yitzchak was ready to raise his child the same way he was raised from Avram. The tradition would continue. He would transmit the values. Esav, bivadai hayach cheshek lamshich dorot shel mekadshei Hashem. Abal Esav b'shelo ba'akshanut ish yodei atzayid b'shum open ein afshur l'taken. The Rav Tzvi points out that ish yodei atzayid means that Esav was immutable. He was inflexible. He was concretized in his place where he was in life. He was no longer going to be influenced to change a direction. So Yitzchak tried to create a model of Yisachar and Zevulun, that one would be the Ish Yodei Tzayid, and that was why he would explain Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav ki Tzayid b'fiv, that he saw the Tzayid as a way of ultimately partnering with Yaakov. So he moves away from the Rishim Shimon Paul Hirsch direction by saying that there was something inadequate or misguided or wrong by this concept, this distinction, this difference between them. He says the difference between Yitzchak and Rivka was not a fundamental personality conflict. It was a philosophical one, which is much more reasonable. Yitzchak believed that Esav would be in a position to support Yaakov in his path to bring the teachings of Abraham to the next generation. Because Yaakov was an Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He was a person that didn't really promote and didn't live by the sword. Rivka understood that someone who is a character, I'm just summing it up now, and I'm adding a little. That's true. If you read that, you'll see you're not going to see all that there. I've learned to say that over my lifetime, because if someone will say, oh, it's not in those words, and then I'll have to say, yes, I know, but that's what he meant. And I can't always say that. So what I will add is that Rivka saw that if somebody is not fit to to take on the role, then there's no good will come out of the relationship. In other words, it's almost like you can't extract from a corrupt partner anything worthwhile. At a point, character does matter. Character matters. And character affects leadership. And even if the leadership would be positive, if the character was corrupt, the result of corrupt character could never be good leadership. I'm adding that. Okay, I'm warning you if you want to look back at the text. And that's a very relevant theme because it comes up very often in the world of leadership. How do we indict a person's leadership if the character is faulty and corrupt? Or could you demarcate and differentiate leadership from a corrupt character? Without obviously answering the question, everyone can go in different directions in understanding the frame of that. It doesn't have to go necessarily to one person, but it is it's a very reasonable question. So the difference between Yitzchak and Rivka was, can you bifurcate Esav? Can you recognize that he had some flaws, but at the same time accept the good? Rivka understood it can't be that way. And by the way, this is one of the points I wanted to add. So I wanted to add 2 points to this conversation. Here's one of them. This is my own interpretation. I know I'm not much of a warrior, and I don't have much to talk about from my past that I had the privilege of serving in Sahel. But this came to me at a certain point in my life, and I think it's important to note it. To say it when in the context. So I'm not really trying to... When I was flipping pancakes in the army, okay, that's nothing... I have no other story to tell you. This is it. But you all know when a chayal receives his neshek or her neshek, they receive their neshek with a tanach, and they receive the neshek. If any of you have ever seen it, it's a really beautiful ceremony, and it's. I'm still so relieved and pleased that in every generation there hasn't been that... The swelling of opposition to when someone will have a problem with giving the neshek with a tanach. It's just another probably 50 years where someone will come up with an opposition to that concept. It dawned on me when that ceremony takes place, this story. Because I think that's pshat, what Rivka understood, hakol kol Yaakov v'hayidayim edei Esav. That in order for a Jewish warrior to be effective, the first and the primary core identity has to be the voice of Jacob each time you shave all in, but it doesn't come at the expense of Yadayim Yedei Esav. That at times Jews are called to go to battle and to actually be warriors and to be involved in acts that are very violent. If the core of a Jewish army is HaKol Kol Yaakov, the voice, the inner voice of Jacob, then the Yadayim Yedei Esav will always remain pure. But if the kol is not one of Yaakov, if it's just Yadayim Yedei Esav, distinct from the kol, there is no core, then it's just Yadayim Yedei Esav. And that is, I think, the difference between Rivka and Yitzchak. Rivka understood that. And when Yaakov presents himself as HaKol Kol Yaakov, Yadayim Yedei Esav, Yitzchak is puzzled. How could I have the kol of Jacob, but the hands of Esav? This became, I believe, a very strong metaphor to what ultimately evolved into the Tanakh and the weapon at the same time. Whereas the Tanakh would represent the kol Yaakov, and the weapon represented Yadayim Yedei Esav. So that's on a personal anecdote that I've always felt that Parsha Toldot gives us. So we have a Rav Shimshon verse is critical. We have Rav Tzvi Yehuda to some degree is critical, but less so, because he removes it from the realm of being misinformed and misguided to one of legitimate disagreement between parents on what's philosophically correct in an approach to understanding human character, human development. The second to last comment I wanted to share with you before I get to something I wanted to add about the Parsha is Rav Cook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook. I try not to read too much because I think it's not really fair to read if not everyone has fluency in Hebrew. It kind of loses some of its meaning. But in this case, it's always more difficult to sum up Rav Cook, even though this is one of the more easier essays that Rav Cook wrote. Top of the page, Vina Yaakov be'oto yoshev olim v'davak tamid b'midah te'emet b'chesed. Yaakov did not know how to use his weapons, his hands. He didn't know how to have violent tendencies. And this is so consistent with Rav Cook's philosophy about the birth of the rebirth of the Jewish people. And he said, how could Yaakov ever be the leader of the Jewish people if he wouldn't be able to manage engaging in some degree of warfare? Al kein chashav Yitzchak ki odlo nivrara haskula lagamre. He thought, Yitzchak thought that the skula, this, the word skula here, Rav Kook uses it in a very well-known letter. They wrote letter 555. Rav Kook writes, and he gets this from the Kuzari, that there was a I guess it's a little bit too much in the vernacular to use the word, but it's still the best way to describe it. There was a chosenness, a kind of a Harry Potter-esque thing going on since the beginning of the Chumash. And each one was chosen and one was deselected, as I said a little earlier. And when Abraham finished with this, so when Sarah died, he remarried and then had multiple children from Keturah. And these children, we never hear from them again. There was a path, and there was secondary paths that were coming out of the Avot. The primary path was called the Skula. Rav Kook writes about some of this in letter 555. He says that a Skula of a Jewish person could never change. It's always there, it's eternal, it can never be taken away. He says that the person has a choice whether or not to exercise and manifest this Skula. That's the choice that everybody has. But the Skula itself is something which is born for a convert, it's embraced, and it becomes part of a soul of a human being. So Rav Kook writes, so when it came to Yaakov, he said he just didn't sense that Yaakov had this selectiveness, this degree of special quality. Like Moshe Rabbeinu when he's born, Vayater Ki Tovu. Remember that pasuk that Yocheved saw that he was good? What does that mean, he was good? What mother says that a child isn't good? It's really what Jewish mother says that child is good. I was once interviewing a young parent, and I asked her, "What was? Tell me a little about your children." And she said, "Well, my daughter's just okay." I said, "Just okay? Yeah, she's mediocre. It's like everybody else. She's average." I said, "I don't think I've ever heard a Jewish mother explain that her child's just average. Okay, who are you?" She said, "I'm a convert." And I, silly me, I didn't look at the file. And I looked at the file, I would have seen that the mother converted, and I shouldn't ask that question. I said, "That's very refreshing from time to time to interview a convert. This is a story I'm going to tell over and over again," even though I completely embarrassed myself. I burst out in laughter when I said that. It was like I couldn't even contain myself. I said, at least I was right, though. I still never heard a mother say that. My position stands. That's uncontested. And yet Yaakov said that ki lo nivras gula lagamrei vimki Yaakov tovo kishulatzmo ra'inu kvar habeit tzadikim. There's no question that Yaakov is an ish tam, but he said you can see a lot of righteous people in the world that they're very unproductive tzadikim. A Noach, I mean, he was a ishkula, but not every tzadik is going to be the chosen one. V'kevin shirash tzeh koach shel hitgabrut v'nitzachon chasel Yaakov lagamrei. He said there was nothing, there was no dynamism, there was no charisma, there was no character yet to Yaakov. And he wasn't the firstborn. By the way, that's absolutely not correct, because everyone who was chosen in the Chumash was not the firstborn. Cain was the oldest one. Yishmael was older than, not in the same birth mother, but still he was older. Esau was older than Yitzchak. And Yosef and Yehuda were older than Reuven. So the older theory here, David HaMelech was the youngest in the family. As we know that Shmuel didn't even want to pay attention to him. He saw in Esav the future. Al Cain vayehav Yitzchak et Esav kitzayid b'fiv. He saw this in the future. Now, what Yitzchak was doing, I think I have to stop here. Read it. You can read it on your own. It's a very interesting essay. What Yitzchak was doing is that he saw a characteristic that he believed would be manifest in the future that would ultimately be the leadership model. And that's why we started the class. Could you notice the tense difference? And I have to, full disclosure, I think it's a bit of a kvetch because Vayehav is not necessarily in the future, but Rav Kook, he comments on that, he recognizes it. Vayehav Yitzchak et Esav ki tzayid b'fiv. He loved him because he had tzayid b'fiv. In other words, there really was a reason why he loved him, because he saw the one, the chosen one, the one who was able to lead the Jewish people kind of like Bar Koziba. Remember, Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was a Mashiach. One of the signs of Mashiach, if you look in the Rambam, is that he has to be a warrior. He has to be a general. He has to lead people into war. That is a sign of Mashiach. By the way, I think, not that I'm Chabad, I'm not Lubavitch, but that's probably the reason why the Lubavitch have used so many metaphors of around military. Mitzvah tank, for instance. Tzivot Hashem, the army of God. You'd have to ask Lubavitch people directly. I don't have much initiation into the community, but it always struck me that there are some military metaphors flying around Lubavitch vernacular, and I believe that's probably the reason, because Melech Mashiach has to be a general. So getting back to this, he saw him vayehav in the future. Rivka, on the other hand, if you skip down, I'll just read it without you. It's right. We see where those two lines are that I put, those dashes, three lines above the first dash. V'gabei ahavat Rivka ohevet Yaakov lashon hoveh. Rivka saw the present and saw him in the moment. And she kira v'yada midvar Hashem sheskulak far nivara. Of course, she had the prophecy, which we discussed earlier. V'ein tzorach od hester u'birur achre b'chala akein ohevet mitzad atzma. That's why there is no ahava shetluya bedavar. There is no key when it comes to Rivka's love for her son, because Rivka saw in the present. What she saw in the present, she thought was already an indication that he is the chosen one of the two. Now, legitimately, it's not by accident that they fall in line with each other. Rav Tzvi Yehuda was the son of Rav Amram Yitzchok Cook. There is some parallel that they both try to explain, that there was a philosophical difference between them. One was Yisachar and Zvulun, we saw Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and his father, Rav Amram Yitzchok Cook, looked at more about who would be the ultimate leader for the Jewish people. I'd like to add two more points to this. One is my father's, but one is my own that I think is an important comment to make. Whether or not you also think it's important, it's up to you to judge. I certainly don't want to prejudice you, because it's not one that I read, so I can't come with illegitimacy that it has. It has the veracity and the validity of something which has been time tested over tradition. On a side, my father, Zichron Bracha, said later on in the parsha, it says Vatechena Einav Meiraot, Yaakov Yitzchak's eyes were dimmed. So some of you remember the Rashi, a very beautiful Rashi. Remember the Rashi? I see you're taking the tears of the angels streamed into. Again, that's taken literally. It's a beautiful story. Taken metaphorically, perhaps it means Yitzchak was on the Akedah, and he saw his father betraying him. The tears of betrayal were streaming through his eyes. Later on in life, when he needed to show love, he said he'll never betray his child. It would be unconditional. It would never again be a father betraying the love of a child. So Vatechena Einav Meiraot, his eyes were dimmed. They were affected by the Akedah, because subconsciously or consciously, he remembered how he felt when he was cast aside and he was neglected, or even worse, he was abused. He said he would never do this to his own child. That was one way of the Vatechena Einav Meiraot. My father said that parents... father wasn't passing judgment. Says that it is possible for parents not to see the faults in their own children. But one way to look at it is as the Akedah. One was looking at it as my father said, if a parent doesn't see the fault in their children, but techene navirot, it's not really the tears. It's that people's eyes become dim to their children's faults. To some degree, it could be a blessing. You don't want to micro-examine every child's behavior and then come up with some response and consequence. Parents have to know when to back in and when to back out. It's not an easy balance to find, especially as children reach adolescence. It's a very complicated dynamic between parents and children at that age, and to understand what's within the norm and what's the exception to the norm, what requires intervention, when is trust necessary, and when is questions and interrogation part of a parental responsibility. It's one that every parent has to come to their own. But Techen Amirot is that there is a certain consequence when parents are not seeing their children with clarity and acuity. My father didn't use those words, but that was what he used at Pasuk. But I want to come back to something that I thought of when I was preparing this class. I never really have seen it, so I can't really promote this as something that has the validity, but it's this whole week I've been thinking, and I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity, Dr. Friedman. I don't think I would have thought of it had you not asked me, given me this honor to teach this class. It comes a little from Shimshon Felhirsch. But Kitzayid Befiv, Getting back to this congregation show for Hirsch, when a child exhibits behaviors which creates distance from a parent, the most undesirable outcome is for a parent to distance himself or herself. During adolescence, when children push away, the natural tendency of people when they're pushed away is to become removed, is to get pushed away. That's what we do. People, it's flight or fight. You can either flight. Most people go flight. They don't want to engage in such an acrimony and rancor. They don't stay particularly engaged. When a child is exhibiting behaviors which are antithetical, let's say from this point of view, from a religious point of view, from a social point of view, from a cultural point of view, however you want to frame it, it becomes difficult. It really is. It becomes difficult for parents to love their children. They can love their children. I heard once one girl said to me, "My parents love me, but they don't like me." That was a really that was a shock comment for the guy. That stunned me. That not that she had so much insight. I think kids have an enormous amount of insight, but she framed it in such a coarse way. My parents love me, but they don't like me. It becomes difficult to show love when a parent is feeling repulsed or repelled by a child. That's a natural tendency. Instead of finding fault in Yitzhak, I think we can find Yitzhak as the paradigm of the super parent. Because there was no question that Esav was taking a path that was divergent. He said it. We saw it, Rav Cook pointed it out. Rav Shinshon Falosh, everyone pointed out. Keith Said Befiv, he was a Rasha. He was a no good Nick. He was following a devious path. He was involved in trickery. He was malicious. Whatever we'd say about Esav, it would fit into the category. Under those circumstances, and this is what I'd like to add to this conversation, a parent actually has to find something that is lovable in a child to keep the child close. There needs to be an embrace of a child who is not following in the cultural, social, religious ways of a parent. It's easy just to discharge and to dispel and to disregard and discard a child. It really is at a certain point. It's harder to find a point of love and attraction for someone you're not naturally attracted to. That's why the pasuk tells us, V'yehav Yitzchak et Esav, in the future. Because it was a struggle for him. It was a struggle. Instead of criticizing Yitzchak, I find Yitzchak as an inspiration. Ki tzayid b'fiv, because he knew that he would love him because of this. Let's get back to what Rav Shimon Falosh says. This opposite attracts, this inability for Yitzchak to be a hunter, this appreciation he had for his character. V'rivko hevet Yaakov. So Rivka is simple. Rivka, we get it. It was easier to love Yaakov. It was harder to love Esav. And that's why I think the Torah goes out of its way to tell us what Yitzchak did. Now, this doesn't necessarily explain the difference between the two, but I think it takes the edge off the way that Shimshon Farl Hirsch started. When there's a child in the family that's, in a way, that's behaving antithetical to what the family morals and mores and culture is, and one parent is going out of his way or her way to embrace and to include, that doesn't mean that Rivka was wrong or Yitzchak was wrong. They split their roles up. It was a division of labor. There's a division of labor. Yitzchak said, "Okay, I'm going to take this one. He's my project. I got him." And Rivka was still the mother who loved both children, albeit it doesn't fit in so well with the brachot piece. But also, you could explain it. That try to shower the child love. Give him more brachot. Maybe it'll come better. Maybe it'll come back. And Rivka said, "No, that's it. It can't go on like this. We can't keep on giving him the chances and deselect Yaakov." At a certain point, Rivka said that this can't continue with all the best of intentions. And the interesting part, which I won't have a chance to go into now, if you look at the end of the parsha, okay, Itzalta li bracha, I think there's the words that the Chumash says, "Have you left any brachot for me?" What's so interesting is that if you look at the end of Parsha Toldot, this is a most fascinating part of the end of the story that I think goes completely undernoticed and underrated. I have, I think, one more minute. They come back and forth and they ask for brachot. Perek Kav Zayin Pasuk Lamed Chet. Bayom Reis Laviv HaBracha Achat Hi Lecha Avi. Is there one bracha left for me? Barcheni Gamani. Please bless me. So he gives him this secondary bracha, which is very nice. And you think the story is over, right? Story is not over. Story continues. V'achar b'cha tichyeh, v'atachicha ta'avod, v'yugad l'rifka. Now, Yaakov is ready to leave. And Rivka says, now Rivka speaks up. Vatomer Rivka Yitzchak, katzti b'chayai mipnei benot chet. I had enough of these women here. We got to send them away. Look at Per Kav Chet Pasuk Aleph. You'll do on your own because we don't have the time. Vayikra Yitzchak el Yaakov, yavarecho tov yitzveo v'yomar. And he gave him a bracha. And what bracha does he give him? Look at Pasuk Dalet. Vayitein lecha et birkat Avraham. Which means he always had Birkat Avraham in his pocket. He never gave it away. He only gave it away at the end. Which means that when the whole ruse was happening, he knew that Esav would never get Birkat Avraham. It's not made up. This was all part of a master plan, somehow or another, that Yaakov would get Birkat Avraham, even after he knew there was a trick. He still didn't give Birkat Avraham to Esav. He gave Birkat Avraham still to Yaakov, which underscores my assumption that the level of criticism that's levied upon Yitzhak and Rivka may be unwarranted. And there may have been a very legitimate parental strategy that was informing this relationship. I'll have to stop here.
Very nice. Yeah. Thank you. Simpson says they make these.